for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 253, and happy Halloween! I'm glad you're listening to this Halloween spectacular. I have four great interviews with four terrific comics creators, all related to Halloween. First up is Ted Sikora from APAMA. APAMA. He's got a Kickstarter going on right now, and it will conclude on Halloween night, appropriately enough. If you'd like to help with this Kickstarter, go to Kickstarter.com and look up APAMA Volume 2. We'll talk in depth about that book and how you can participate. Then Sam Johnson returns and talks about Geek Girl Number 1, which will become available this Wednesday, November 2. We talk in depth about that book as well and how you can access it. Then Frank Martin is back, and he's already created a really great combination of novella and comic that you're really going to enjoy, and he talks in depth about that as well and how you can access that. Then everything wraps up with Jack Montgomery, the artist on Sanguine Nights, a really different vampire tale and one I think you're going to enjoy. We talk about how you access that as well. More than ever, there's a lot to get to, so let's get to it. It's great to welcome to the podcast Ted Sikora, one of the creators of APAMA, the Undiscovered Animal, and a current Kickstarter that's going on, Volume 2, and some other good things going on. How are you doing today, Ted?
I'm great, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you. And we were just talking before I started to record that I spoke with you first, I think it was at Space up in Ohio this year. That's where I think I got the trade, and I also got the disc. And I just this whole thing just fascinates me. I love this kind of things. And I also saw you at New York not long ago. So you're doing the same convention tour, it seems like, that we are, that Richard Rivera and I are going around doing.
Well, yeah, we're starting to branch out a little bit. We've stayed regional, but New York is as far as we've gone. But that'll be beaten if we go to Stan Lee's Comic-Kazi in Los Angeles. Are you doing that one?
No, we're not doing that one. I wish I could go to that one, but unfortunately, no. We're going to be going to a Tampa Bay. It's a MegaCon Tampa Bay for the first time they're doing that, and we'll be there. So, oh, man. Will your Kickstarter be done by then?
October 31st.
APAMA, the Undiscovered Animal. Of course, everybody who wants to know what in the world is an APAMA, and of course, you even put that question on the cover of the trade. Do you want to talk a little bit about what an APAMA actually is, or if there actually is such a thing?
Sure. Well, it might make sense to tell it sort of in order, starting with the film.
Okay.
So Milo Miller and I co-wrote Hero Tomorrow, and we've been huge comic book fans our whole life. Mm-hmm. And really what we wanted to do is have this sort of indie film that had this comic book love baked into it. Mm-hmm. So it's about a guy, it's a love story, dark comedy, and the guy in it has an idea for a superhero. He's a struggling comic book creator. Mm-hmm. And his idea for a superhero is based on the premise that so many heroes are creature themed, but all the good ones have already been taken, mm-hmm. you know, the spider, the bat, etc. Mm-hmm. So he decides, well, I'm going to make up an animal that's so powerful yet stealth. Mankind has still yet to discover this. And he calls this an APAMA. And his superhero is APAMA, like Wolverine is, Wolverine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this really makes no sense to publishers. That's part of the humor of the movie. And mm-hmm. and APAMA was originally made for the movie to be this idea that he just couldn't sell. Mm-hmm. And a really hard to explain idea at that, you know. So his girlfriend in the film is an aspiring fashion designer. Mm-hmm. And for Halloween, speaking of, mm-hmm. she has big party coming up, a big networking, thing that she wants to impress some people. So she makes her own costume, but she also makes him a costume of his own character, APAMA. So what could go wrong with that? he's not content to just wear it on Halloween. He starts going out at night, creeping around, you know, looking for crime, all kinds of weirdness goes on. And I won't tell you how it ends, but, you know, the movie, it debuted at Comic-Con International in San Diego, and it played film festivals really all over the world. And one of the things we heard over and over was, you know, his Apama idea is kind of cool. You guys really ought to try it as a comic book. And we thought about this Apama idea a lot for the movie. And, you know, we were thinking, well, if this really was a book and it was about a guy who discovers this thing, and, you know, we just decided, all right, what if we just do the book that was in his head? If he could have just got Apama published, what would that be? So we started from zero. You know, the movie's its own thing. But this is the book then, Apama, the Undiscovered Animal, is about a Hungarian ice cream truck driver in Cleveland who discovers the spirit force of the most savage creature mankind has never known.
I got to ask, why that particular circumstance?
Which one?
the Hungarian ice cream truck driver. You know, that's not many comic characters are Hungarian ice cream truck drivers in Cleveland. Why did you decide to go that route?
Well, I mean, that is kind of the reason in itself, because we wanted to do something very different. It takes a lot of effort to put out a comic book, you know, and we thought, if we're going to do this, let's do something that people haven't seen before. And, you know, my father, when I was growing up, he had a tire store. I was changing tires with these dudes, and they were a riot, you know, and it was like I didn't feel like that kind of alter ego was represented in the superhero comic book world. So – yeah, I mean, he drives an ice cream truck, so he's not brilliant like Peter Parker or Reed Richards, right? He's not wealthy with a ton of resources like a Bruce Wayne, Tony Stark. He's not a honed warrior, you know, and it becomes a very different kind of book because, you know, he's got the problems of a guy who, you know, drives an ice cream truck for a living, and he's not the smartest dude either, you know, so... where, you know, you'll go through an issue of Spider-Man and Peter Parker just methodically figures something out. Our character thinks he's figuring something out, but he's completely wrong, you know.
But isn't that, you're right, that is something we don't see very often. Because to be honest, everybody who's a hero is either the smartest or the luckiest person we ever get on the planet. And I kind of get a little tired of that sometimes. It was nice to actually read about somebody who was a little different, who had to struggle and had to think things out and had to, you know, had to take on different circumstances than, say, a Batman or a Spider-Man might. And I like that. And, of course, setting it in Cleveland, of course, is something interesting. Are you a native of Cleveland?
Yes.
Okay, so you are. Sorry. And we were talking just before the we started to record also about the fact that your Indians just won the chance to go to the World Series, which is going to date when we record this a little bit. But congratulations again for that. I'm sure you're very thrilled.
We are thrilled, you know. And I, if I can go back, you know, a few months, I mean, that Cavs championship was – I just don't think there'll be anything that could ever top that in my lifetime. That was just so incredible. I'm thrilled for the Indians, but – when you look at championships in the history of professional sports, we waited for over 50 years with three different teams. You know, you can't even find that in another city, let alone playing a team like the Warriors, who had the best record of all time in the regular season. And we were down 3-1, which has never come. No one's ever come back from 3-1 in the finals. Like, the whole thing had so much drama points. It's just like, I don't know. Well, still cloud nine.
Enjoy it, man, and have a great time with it, because I'm a fan of a lot of the teams from the Washington, D.C. area, and I happened to be their fan when Joe Gibbs was the coach of the Washington football team, and some people get bothered by the name of it. But I loved that year. There was a year when they just cleaned everybody's clock, and I was just... I had such a great year that year, and it was so funny how everybody, no matter where you were on the political spectrum, you were a fan of the football team. And those of us who couldn't talk about any other subject were talking about the football team. And it was just, it's the kind of thing sports does. It brings people together. And I'm sure you guys are going to have a great time. Hope they win for your sake, but, you know, even if they don't, I think you're going to have a wonderful time.
Yeah. We're thrilled to have the opportunity. And yeah, I remember those Joe Gibbs teams. Like, isn't he the only coach who's ever won Super Bowls with, what, three different quarterbacks? Is that him?
That's very likely. That man was a genius. He could sit there and make the miracles pop out, and we'd all be sitting there watching at home and go, how did he do that? you know, glad he's on our team, you know, kind of thing. But they haven't quite been as lucky since then, so we may be in a, hopefully won't have a drought as long as you guys have had, but right. We'll see if we can't get some. Okay, back to Cleveland. See, I'm fascinated, too, about the fact that you're basing this in your hometown. Have you ever read a strip called Captain Kentucky?
No.
there was a Sunday paper in, I can't remember the main city in Kentucky. There was a guy that he was like a reporter, and he got a hold of something, some radioactive stuff called like octahexaglup. And what he would do is he would take that and he would get powers, and he wore the Kentucky state flag as his cape and stuff. And you know, the terrible thing was, not being from that area, if when I go back and look at the stuff and I read the books, I don't know a lot of the inside jokes that are going on there. And I had a feeling when I read your book too, where there was several inside jokes I didn't get. You know, because of the Cleveland thing. This is, if you're from Cleveland, you probably get a lot more than I did out of the book. Although I enjoyed the book tremendously. But I get a huge kick, and I don't know why people don't do that more. You know, it's like holiday songs. A lot of regions have their own little holiday song that stands out for them. And I don't understand why people don't have more not New York City-based people in comics. Did you find that more of a challenge, or was it easier to write him? Because, you know, you're the breaking new ground as far as Cleveland goes.
We did find that, you know, Cleveland was just a blank canvas for this kind of story, you know, and Cleveland has sort of a brand too, you know, and it's kind of nice to tap into that, you know, and a lot of the reviews, you know, we've gotten on the book, even if people aren't from Cleveland, really like that it's set there. And we try not to do too many wink kind of things, you know, that would be Cleveland specific. But just the fact that it would, when you would read an issue of Spider-Man, there's probably, you know, I know there's a lot of New York kind of things in there. Mm-hmm. We tried to, you know, just tell the story as if we were, you know, imagining this universe from day one, and, you know, all the heroes are born before your eyes, the villains are born before your eyes. And, you know, looking back at what Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko did all those, you know, decades ago, and that's the kind of story you can no longer tell in the Marvel and DC universe, where you're starting and it's something new. Everything that happens in Marvel's Manhattan is kind of under this umbrella of the city has seen this so many times. You know, they've seen Galactus come, they've seen everything. And it's like, in our world, this is the first superhero they've ever seen. And I think that gives it hopefully a fresh take.
I always get a kick, because my brother always likes to say that New York City should have been rebuilt 8 times by now.
Yeah.
Because they keep devastating huge sections of New York City every once in a while. And then the next time the comic comes out, back up. So yeah. We always get a huge kick out of that. As far as Cleveland goes, did you, because you know you got the second volume coming out. Did you kind of have fun with it? You know, like, was there some business or something that maybe you thought should get a black eye or something, and you kind of decided to go and have some fun with them or something? How did you go about doing that? Or did you kind of stay away from that and just try to be a real positive as far as a representation of Cleveland?
We just try to be authentic. You know, there was a show called The Drew Carey Show that was, you know, set in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of that one?
Yes, I've seen it many times.
Okay, you know, and I always felt that show, it was a good show, but I also felt it was a little too rah-rah Cleveland, you know. We wanted it to be what Cleveland is, you know, and there's an authenticity to Cleveland, and we don't try to overstate how great it is. We think it's great, but we don't say that. We'll show you what's great about it by the people who hang out there, that drink the coffee, and that are just living in this environment. So there wasn't – I haven't had an axe to grind with any particular business or anything like that.
Because the reason I say that is Captain Kentucky, the mayor of Louisville, I think it was quite the risque character. And he was forever doing terrible things to him. And I was always kind of like, after a while, you began to think that maybe the citizens there weren't all there enamored with their own mayor. But, you know, he actually went over, and this will tell you how long ago this was. They actually sent him over to Tehran in Iran, and they bombed the place while he was over there. And I was like, man, they really don't care for their mayor all that much. This was in a Sunday newspaper.
Wow.
And it was just so interesting, because it's kind of nice that you're actually not going that route, that you actually have a more realistic spin on it and having these things happen as if it were in a current day Cleveland kind of stuff, which I like about it too. You know, one of the things I thought you guys did a really great job of setting up the characters, that they're believable characters. You know, a lot of comics, you kind of get to know them as a stereotype a lot of the times. But your ones, the way you write them, particularly the main character, I really got to like him. He gets beaten up occasionally, which is, I always thought, you know, the X-Files, one of the greatest things about that was that they were forever getting the tar beat out of them. They were ending up in hospitals and things like that. And with your book, you take a much more realistic move as far as a superhero genre goes. And I really like that. I thought that was one of the things about your book that really recommends it, was not necessarily getting, you know, following the standard comic trope kind of thing. But was that something you want to accomplish too, do something? You talked about wanting to do something we hadn't seen before. As far as the hero goes, was it he to be more human, a little less noble?
Well, yeah, you know, it's looking at what Stan Lee, you know, when you look at how... I mean, a lot of people argue about, was it Stan Lee or Jack Kirby or you know, Steve Ditko, who did what? But it's pretty irrefutable that Stan was the one who brought the humanity to the characters. Because you can look at what Jack Kirby did before he teamed up with Stan Lee, and you know, very interesting, you know, Challengers of the Unknown and things like that. But the humanity of the Fantastic Four is not present in those characters. You know, the Fly is not Peter Parker, you know? Right. So to me, that's what always made those characters so great. You know, I mean, obviously the illustrations and the design are fabulous, you know, so to answer your question. Yeah. I mean, Stan Lee, that human thing. And it's a thing that unfortunately I think Marvel has really gotten away from, you know, because the universe has gotten so big. And to talk about even your point about how the city gets destroyed every 2 years. When I was growing up reading comics, Amazing Spider-Man, you know, we're talking the 70s. The city wasn't getting decimated every 5 issues, you know. These and there were no guest stars. You know, you would go 5 years before you'd see a guest star in Amazing Spider-Man. You know, it was just him, Peter Parker, his supporting cast, the villains, the great rogues gallery. That's what we wanted to get back to. And, you know, I give lectures on comic creation, and I teach some classes. And the thing I harp on with everybody is character is everything. You know, you can apply the Hollywood story arc to anything, but if you don't have great characters, it's worthless. Mm-hmm. So I think character is so, so important. So, we spent a ton of time really thinking about Ilya, you know, who becomes the Apama. Like, Ilya Jarsky is like, you know, yeah, he's an ice cream truck driver. He's, you know, down on his luck. He's got a pet rat. You know, I mean, we go through it. We analyze these people, all of them, and there's no throwaway characters. You know, we have plans for. And so what you'll see over the course of these first 11 issues, you know, the first volume was issues 1 through 5. This is going to be 6 through 11, is this building of this rogues gallery. And even the villain who showed up in issue 5, Regina, she's like this hippie, psychedelic flower child gone wrong. We kind of call her the human bad trip. I wrote a whole screenplay about her origin that's not even in the book, you know, but it's like that's the level of detail we go into with these characters. So when they do show up in the page, there's a lot behind what they're saying that we've thought about that is still yet to be revealed.
And that comes through in the book and in the writing that you guys are doing, because I don't mean to push on some folks, but there's some comics writers that it feels like a video game to me. You know, I don't care about what's going on to anybody. It's just something's happening, and so it's like watching an accident, you know. You just keep watching it because you can't take your eyes off all the stuff's going on. But to me, I thought your book was great because, like you said, you put a lot of thought and a lot of emotion into the characters and made things, you know, things didn't always go well for everybody. Things kind of went poorly on occasion, and I like that kind of thing. I want to care about these people. And the great thing, too, is you balance action with character. There's a lot of character bits that go on interacting. In fact, I want to talk real quickly about one of the things that happens early is how he gets his powers. He sees an image, and he has to duplicate the position that is in that image. And so he spends several pages.
Yeah, Mom.
you know, going on and doing this stuff. And I'm just, I have to start to smile. And again, this is one of the things that Stan Lee did, was introduce humor as a viable option in comics. You know, a lot of people now say if it's funny, it's not a real comic. But Stan Lee would completely disagree with you, because he always put a lot of humor in this kind of stuff. And I thought it was great the way you did that, that he didn't immediately figure it out, but there he was constantly doing it. He's actually doing it out of habit at one point. And I got a huge kick as I'm watching that. I'm just kind of smiling and going like, you know, to somebody outside, this would seem like a really strange thing, but to somebody who wants to get the powers, they're going to do what it takes to get those powers. And I just love that whole initial section. It makes you feel for him in a very strong way, because here he is trying all he can to get that. And when it happens, even he's kind of surprised by it, seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you had that reaction to it. And yeah, it's sort of that balance of everyday life kind of humor, I think, is what, because sometimes when I'm talking the book up at shows, people ask me, so is this a comedy? And it's a really complicated answer. You know, I'm just like, well, it's funny in the way I think everyday life can be funny, but it turns to horror on a dime, you know. And I think a lot of times, you know, the look of our book is very much kind of Bronze Age. Mm-hmm. People might look at it initially and think, so is this like a parody? Mm-hmm. And like, no, I mean, we play it. And, you know, you explain to somebody that this is about a Hungarian ice cream truck driver. Yeah. And they're like, so it's a comedy parody? I'm like, no, it's played completely straight. Mm-hmm. The weirdness of everything around him.
But, you know, our lives aren't deadly serious all the time. There's humor. Something silly happens and we laugh about it, kind of stuff. And to me, a comic character that can handle both or all aspects of reality, I think, is a much better comic character than, you know, somebody who is just constantly in the dreads and just constantly in terrible shape. So I thought you guys did a really good job of building that into that and making all these characters really believable. And, you know, sometimes they react very humanly. They get, oh no, what are you doing, you know, kind of stuff. You know, where in most comics they kind of all stand around going like, what's he do? Why should we be watching this kind of stuff? But you really do a nice job of bringing those things in. And another thing I wanted to really point out was the art. Somewhere John Buscema is going, man, you know, he's got the spirit of the Apama in him. I think your artist, and let me see if I can pronounce it right, Benito Gallego?
Yeah, I think it's Gallego.
Gallego, okay. He's got the spirit of John Buscema inside of him someplace, because, wow, a lot of his art was just like John Buscema had actually drawn it and stuff. So it's really wonderful. Of course, to an old John Buscema and Sal Buscema fan like I am, it's just a pleasure to read. I was like, wow, look at that. You know, it's so great to see somebody that can still do Buscema and make it look really good and make it vibrant. I really loved it.
Well, absolutely. You know, we were so, so blessed to get Benito on board. And what we did is there was a website called DeviantArt.com. And, you know, a lot of artists contribute to that and post their portfolios. And we put an ad out there, you know, saying we're doing the spinoff of this feature film. We got like 100 artists who submitted from all over the world.
Wow.
And Benito was our far and away first choice. It was just like, oh my gosh, this is like, I'm looking at a classic comic, you know, and to think that we could actually make a book that looked like our favorite stuff of all time, you know, that was just so, so exciting. And, you know, again, I think our approach throughout the whole thing is, let's look at what we loved about the Bronze Age, you know, and try to modernize it. So we bring back things like the thought clouds, which comics have gotten away from those, and the heavy dramatic narration, you know, the melodrama. And then, you know, his art is so cool. So, yeah, you could look at it and think at first glance that it's an intentional throwback thing. But we try to just sort of blend in with the classics, I think, you know.
Well, this is the kind of thing that indie comics do the best, I think, is that you don't necessarily have to be a parody. You don't necessarily have to be anything. You just tell your story. And, you know, we're so fortunate today in the fact that we've got, like, Kickstarter and all these other things that make, like, Apama possible. Because, you know, I worry, and every once in a while I fret out loud about the fact that I wonder how many wonderful stories we missed because Kickstarter wasn't there to help make them happen.
Yeah, it's a wonderful platform, and we primarily use it to get the printing done because, you know, you get to a point where we kind of create the pages, but to get the printing done is going to be like a $7,000 bill, you know, so And that comes all at once. So it's a really nice way for us to raise that printing money. And then, you know, hopefully we can cover enough to get the we're about 90% now on this campaign. So, you know, we'll definitely get there. But to think that going forward, our whole print run is paid for. So now whatever we sell at the shows, we can really think of that as income that goes back into the project or recoups other expenses. It's a nice model if you're not with a, you know, with a distributor or, you know, with a publisher, I should say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, let's talk about how you get APAMA, The Undiscovered Animal, Volume 1. Obviously, you can do that as part of the Kickstarter, but let's say you don't want to do the Kickstarter thing. Do you go through, like, your website? I noticed you got a great named website, APAMA Nation, which I really loved. I thought that was a nice, clever way to do a website name like that. So I like that. Is that the place to go in and get, like, let's say you want a paper or a hardcover, which is available too.
Yeah, and that's APAMA Nation is with APAMA. You know, it's all A's. So that'll take you there. We have a square, you know, shop set up. You can pick out whatever combo of movie or volume one or, you know, that we have.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about volume two. Okay, you've set up all the stuff in volume one. You've done all kinds of things. You've got Regina in there. What can we look forward to seeing in volume two? You said it's actually got more pages than the first one.
Yeah, the first one was 5 issues. This one's 6. And it's because we chose to end on a two-parter. So, you know, 10 and 11 is a two-parter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Regina will be back. We've been setting up a guy in the first 5 issues. And he will be called the Ruster. And he's sort of got this corrosive nature to his chemistry. And we're going to do another thing that's kind of you talk about a wink to Cleveland. It's 10-cent beer night. And it's not that you have to know the history of this to appreciate the story, but back in the 70s, the Indians actually did have a 10-cent beer night. And it's one of the only times in the history of Major League Baseball that a game was forfeit because the crowd got so unruly. It was a big disaster. And it's really, if you ever get a chance to just look it up, 10-cent beer night, there's some funny, funny stories about it. So we just imagine that as if it's taking place in present day. And Ilya goes to the ballpark with his bowling buddies and they're watching the game. And so that's a crazy story. But what happens in issues 10 and 11 that we're really excited about is Ilya joins a theater troupe, a local theater troupe, and they're putting on this horror show musical, and it's called Nothing Like Vaudeville. And the show that the theater troupe is putting on is sort of the story of this runaway freak who collides with all these villains in this mystical land of vaudeville. So there's villains like Sir Terror, the tap dance killer, wax museum owner named Fletcher, and this ringmaster. And so what ends up happening is 3 of the actors, they kind of get locked into their roles mentally, and they believe they're sort of in this old crime world. And I don't want to give too much more away about it. But the one character in particular, this woman, the tap dance killer, we have huge plans for her. Like we're going to be doing a spinoff series of the tap dance killer. So she'll debut in this next set. And you can see images of her on our Kickstarter campaign, too.
Now, is Volume 2 the last one, or is there more coming from you guys?
More coming. Yeah, there's no end in sight for all this.
Oh, good. Well, that's nice to hear. So that'll be lots of fun to do that. Now I just got to ask one question that keeps coming to my mind is, the trades, you know, our collection, but you haven't done individual issues before. The trade is the only way that it comes in paper, right?
Yeah, we don't do anything kind of either the smart or natural way. You know, we started with the movie, then we did the comic, and we don't put out single issues. We go right to the collection because, well, we have not found a way to really make money doing single issues. It would just kind of break our backs, I think. The collection, well, let me say this. The first collection, we were selling single issues on Comixology, and then we did the trade that collected the first 5. 5, though, debuted with the collection. So this time we decided to just hold all the issues back, and it's going to be like a Netflix series where you just can binge on them all. And, you know, that's we'll see how this goes, but it's kind of a neat way to do it because we've found, you know, you think issue 6 and 7 is done, but as we're you know, writing issue 10, we're realizing, hey, if we go back and do this to issue 6, imagine what that's going to do for this moment that comes later. So there's a real cohesiveness to this collection that I don't think you can really get doing it otherwise.
Wow. Well, there has to be a real appetite for it, because look at how well you're doing in your Kickstarter. So, you know, it hasn't hindered anybody by not having the individual issues, because they want the collected group. So
we took some, we surveyed some people, and I was I've always been a single floppy issue guy, but when I was asking folks, it seemed more and more people do prefer the collections. How about you?
I go both ways, honestly. I'm bipolar in that way. I like to read the individual issues as they come out, and I'll collect the trade if I really like the story or stuff that's going on with it. But on the other hand, there are some trades I just buy outright, sometimes to catch up on what's going on. Other times, just because I'm intrigued by the story. And there are some companies that don't put out individual issues. And some of them, I really like their stuff. It's going to depend on whether the story intrigues me. And that's why I bought your trade when I was at Space. Because I was really fascinated by, I love this notion of local heroes. I really do. I just I don't know why more people don't do that. But, and I was just fascinated by the whole thing. And I'm just, knowing that you're going to go forward and have many more to go, that's just real encouraging. I think that's such a, you've got your own little niche right now. That is something that, if you want something that's a little different, this is the place to go to get it.
Thank you.
Now, are there other things you guys are working on? Because I'm pretty much figuring at this point, based on how you're doing, that this Kickstarter is going to be successful, and you're going to go on from there. Do you know, by the way, when the books are going to be coming out after the Kickstarter's done?
We're aiming for March of 17.
March of 17. Okay, so that'll be good. So are there other projects you guys are working on, or is Apama kind of swallowing you guys whole?
Well, I'm a filmmaker by day, so I do a lot of documentary work, and we're actually developing the story that's in the Palma, the comic, into a feature film. So we've got a screenplay now that we're starting to shop around, and I told you about the musical, this horror show, Nothing Like Vaudeville. That is an actual show that was written back in 92, and there was, before I was ever into I've always been into comics, but before I ever thought about making one, I was an aspiring composer. And so I was the principal songwriter, and I wrote the story to the Nothing Like Vaudeville horror show. So we're doing a new best album of that to coincide with the release of Volume 2 of Apama. And my brother Kurt Sikora also put some of the music, and another guy named Kevin James. So I want to give proper credit to those guys.
Great, great. Well, always good things. You guys do some of the most creative and interesting things that are being done today, I'm really convinced. So if anybody wants to get to Apama, it's apamanation.com. Go to Kickstarter and look for Apama and look for Volume 2, which is out there. And even if they manage to get past the goal, which we hope to do, they hope they'll do before long, still go in there and support, because there are likely to be good stretch goals coming. And you might want to get in on that as well. So, man, Ted, keep up the great stuff and tell everybody you're doing a wonderful book, as well as other things that are related to it. It's all great, exciting things.
Thank you so much, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to talk to Sam Johnson, creator of Geek Girl, and many other good things. And got a big special thing happening this week. How you doing, Sam?
Wayne, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
So what's going on as far as Geek Girl goes?
The series, which I've mentioned to you before, having been on your show a few times, is coming out. The mini series, we've had Geek Girl Zero a while back, but we've got the mini series launching November 2nd with issue 1, 4-issue monthly series.
Great, great. So let's talk about how you get the book. Is this a digital basic one, or is it available in shops? How is this going to happen?
It's in some comic shops. We've done like a limited edition for comic shops. You can get it at Indie Planet. There's a few variants, and they should all be up there. Comixology, and other than that, if you go to the Geek Girl comic book Facebook group, if I've missed anything, it'll be on there.
Okay, great. Now, for those people who may not understand who Geek Girl is, why don't you give us a little background on the character?
So yeah, Geek Girl is a character I created a while back. We had a Geek Girl Zero. We had three printings of this, and that's what kind of why the Geek Girl Facebook groups sort of existed and built up. So Geek Girl is Ruby Kay. She's a hot college chick. She lands these pair of super tech glasses. They give her super strength and flight powers, but there's some sort of glitching in them, and they're also messing with her brain. The initial effect of this is making her super klutzy, but it's things are going to develop from there. So yeah, Geek Girl 1, we recap the origin for those that didn't see Geek Girl 0, but Geek Girl 1, this is kind of Geek Girl proper, in that basically issue 0 was Ruby and her college friends and landing these glasses, and now this is Geek Girl getting thrown into the world of tights and capes.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, too, because you say that she's not necessarily somebody who's given to that kind of thing. You know, how does she take to this whole thing? I mean, it's just kind of interesting because she doesn't seem to be any kind of a comics fan or a geek in the purest sense of the word.
So no.
I find it really interesting that she kind of takes to this. So what makes her do that?
Well, the thing with Ruby Kay and with Geek Girl is it's not just Ruby Kay Geek Girl. It's also Summer James, who's her best friend. Now, Summer is the one that her dad's a comics geek, and she's into the whole superhero thing. It's her that puts the idea in Ruby's head to use the powers in such a way as we as comic fans are familiar with, which Ruby is not so much. They're both at college in Maine. Summer's a fashion designer. Summer designs her costume. So Summer comes up with the name Geek Girl. So basically Summer is kind of the driving force. It's Ruby that's got these glasses, but Summer's the one kind of pushing her in this direction. So Ruby is kind of going with it, but she doesn't really know what the hell she's doing. And at the beginning of issue one, we see her flying about looking for crime, because this is what you do if you're a superhero. She's not been getting anywhere with this, so she's kind of clueless about what she's meant to be doing. But then right there, the Neon Girl, who's the big shot superheroine of Maine where they live, gets blasted through this billboard by this mysterious new villain called Lightning Storm, and Ruby's kind of forced to step up because Neon Girl gets hospitalized, and this dangerous character Lightning Storm is out there, and Neon Girl is like, you know, I don't know when or even if I'm going to get out of this hospital. So you dress like a superhero. So you need to act like one, and you need to stop this lightning storm.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because one of the things I enjoy about your writing is the characterization. I think that you do characters and dialogue real well. And the fun conversation that takes place, even though she's in a hospital bed, between Neon Girl and Geek Girl is just Neon Girl throws out these wonderful expressions that I have to say just, you know, made me like her very much, because, you know, she talks to Geek Girl, says that she just bumped into Lightning Storm, and she said, well, bump into her again hard. Yeah. She goes hard. I love that.
Yeah, well, Neon Girl is a badass, and she's also increasingly succumbing to the effects of the morphine she's on while in that hospital bed. But yeah, Neon Girl is no nonsense. So when this Ruby presents herself in a superhero costume, but is all I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing. Neon Girl is, well, I'm telling you what you're doing.
Which is really good, because as a character, you know, we feel for her, because, you know, let's face it, those of us who are geeks like would love to be in the situation where she's in, where we have these powers. And of course, it always falls to the non-geek to get the powers, you know, and these kinds of good things, which is always great fun, because they have to learn the things that we know as readers. And that's great fun for her. You know, the thing that's so interesting about her is she's flying around for several hours. She doesn't know what to do. She's just like you're saying. And when all this stuff happens to her, she's kind of floored by it. And you can see, and the artwork is really good too, I think, in this very first issue. It's really strong. And we get to see her reaction to all this. When, after flying around, she's kind of a little bored, seems like, on her expression on her face. But when all this stuff starts to happen, she begins to realize this is serious stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when we're saying that Ruby is you know, a hot, popular college chick, she's not what we traditionally see as a geek. But this is, as you mentioned about characters, this is going to be a character development thing. So how Ruby starts out and when she ends up are perhaps going to be different things. And that's partly going to be due to what she's dealing with, but also the way the glasses are affecting her brainwaves, which she's not necessarily aware of. So, yeah, there's a, I think I've veered off a little bit. What was that wasn't your question. What was your question?
Well, that pretty much answered it, I thought, pretty well, as far as the things go about how stunned she is by what is really involved in being superhero.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, that was where I was going to go with it, because, yeah, I mean, we're building to, I mean, as things start in issue one, Ruby wouldn't have a prayer against Lightning Slum. Lightning Slum is just, you know, like that, taken down Neon Girl, who's this big shot. So she's got to, you know, find the strength to go up against Lightning Storm, and that's something we'll be building towards. Well, there's plenty of other things going on in the miniseries as we build towards that as well. I've got other villains such as Nina Dante and Mr. Mashup, A-Game, who are a more comedic affair. They'll be coming down the line. So, yeah, Ruby Kay is going to Geek Girl is going to kind of get introduced to the world of superheroes before stepping up to take on this big bad and seeing whether she's up to it.
Well, there's another character you introduce in this first issue, a guy by the name of Pitbull, at least goes by the name of Pitbull. And he's a real interesting character. I really like him. He's got like a support group around him, and he's not necessarily into the superhero thing either, because when they decide it's time to go out and fight crime, all of a sudden one of them yells out, "Let's get a beer first. Let's get a brewski first." And everybody goes, "Yeah." And so what do? They go for a brewski.
Well, he's Pitbull is like the jock superhero. So it's actually him that he can't, like, basically you've got his apartment. He has his like sort of entourage. I mean, entourage slash friends. They're hanging around playing video games, drinking beer. He pitches up in his costume, having just put it on in the mirror in the bathroom, and he's like, "Yeah, let's fight crime." And they're like, "Yeah." And then he's like, "Let's get brewski first." And they're like, "Yeah." So it's all very full on. So he's very much into the whole superhero thing, but he's like the jock superhero. So he's quite happy to have a few beers while he's at it.
See, that's kind of interesting, because the two of these people have something in common, don't they? If he's the jock guy and she's kind of the upper class girl, whatever, however you want to put it, won't they have something in common? Because, you know, of course you're not going to introduce many characters without having them bump into Geek Girl, so they eventually do start to do something together. And the thing I got a big kick out of about it was I kept thinking, man, these guys are perfect for each other.
Yeah, where that goes is to be determined, because their introduction to each other is not necessarily the most conducive, but that I can't give away what that is without right. bringing it I nearly gave it away by saying the word bringing there. Can't give it away without revealing the end of issue one. But you know, that's an interesting point. But having said that, I mean, Pitbull is this, you know, this superhuman jock, but what Geek Girl is projecting is he's not going to necessarily pick up from that on who Ruby Kay is and what she's about. It would take I think them meeting without costume to get into that.
Okay, because that'll be interesting, because I could see her being attracted to him because of him being a jock. That's the kind of thing that gets to me. But, you know, we'll have to see as this develops, of course. Now, and one of the things I really enjoyed about the book, too, is you take a Geoff Johns kind of ending, in that there's a cliffhanger that takes place there. We can say that the story isn't completely resolved by the end of the book, which is, you know, debut issues these days just don't do that anymore. And you do a very nice Geoff Johns-like cliffhanger that makes us want to come back to issue two.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I'm a, you know, a big comics fan, and you know, Stan Lee had this thing about, I forget how frequently he said to have something that, that makes you turn the page, but a cliffhanger is a good thing, and it's something that continues throughout the series. I mean, the way the I think you'd be hard pressed to predict how this miniseries ends up. I think we keep everyone on their toes with it.
Now, you called it a miniseries. How many issues are going to be in this?
It's 4 issues, and there is an ongoing in the works, all to be published by Marcosia.
Okay. Now, how did you come together with your artist as far as that goes? Because, you know, there's a lot of ways to meet, and it's Carlos Granda is the name of the...
Carlos Granda, yeah. Simply by advertising online. I mean, I live in the UK. He's in Colombia. So it's been done, you know, through the magic of the internet. But it took a while to find him. I mean, as I said, Geek Girl Zero came out some time ago, and there'd been a couple of sort of misstarts with artists. And it took a while to get Carlos, who is definitely the right man for the job, as you've hit on earlier, as he can draw like kick-ass action, and there's some really great like people have commented on the first 3 pages, which are in the preview of the sort of way it's shot, especially like the aerial stuff with Geek Girl. But at the same time, he can do like good facial expressions and physical expressions with these characters. So he's absolutely happy with him, and it's, you know, all 4 issues of the mini are done, all done by Carlos.
Wow.
So that's yeah,
that's great, because many times, you know, I Frank Miller is one of my greatest examples. He'll put something out and he's got a schedule, but then he doesn't necessarily meet it.
Yeah, well, this is something I wanted to avoid. That's why there's been, you know, why it's been in the works as long as it has, because, you know, things happen that cause delays, and I didn't want to fall into that trap. I wanted to make sure that, you know, it was all done and dusted first. So it's, you know, I mean, it's completely finished, the lettering, the colors, the covers. It's all done and ready to come out monthly.
What was that like for you to have that all done?
It was good. I mean, it's been a huge amount of work, and the amount of times I've, you know, fine-tuned the script, but it's absolutely how I want it. And, you know, I'm developing, I've already scripted the first issue of the ongoing, and I'm, you know, developing ideas, and many of the characters that are introduced in the mini, I'm looking forward to developing further and seeing the other dimensions of them, because something that interests me in when I write my stuff, and this is applied to other things like the Almighties and Carbaccini Voodoo Junkie Hitman, which will be though she's had some appearances, that'll be the next mini series from me. I'm interested in having bad guys that are a bit more complex than, you know, let's just take over the world and that kind of thing. So the bad guys that we introduce, Mr. Mashup and Nina Dante, aside from Lightning Storm, I mean, Lightning Storm is a mysterious figure, but she's not necessarily an all-out baddie either. But yeah, it's interesting to sort of see the different layers to these characters, and maybe they're not going to, you know, stay in the same direction. Maybe they're going to change.
I got to ask, though, Nina Dante, is that the blonde girl? They're sitting around, and she's got the glasses, and she hasn't learned the idea what a secret identity is all about. And they ask her to do something with the powers and stuff like that. And this girl, a blonde-haired girl, I'm a little confused right at the moment. Is that Nina Dante, the blonde-haired girl?
No. Nina Dante is not in the first issue.
Okay.
That is Geek Girl, or rather Ruby's clique, you know, are a bunch of popular hot college chicks, and the kind of ringleader of them is Karin, who's the girl you're referring to.
Okay.
And she's too cool for school, and she's not impressed by Ruby's supposed raised fingers, quote unquote, superpowers. So yeah, she is like the enemy to Ruby, the nemesis to Ruby in her college world. Oh. So this is Ruby's nemesis rather than Geek Girl's.
Well, the expression, she's talking about, you know, stuff gets all over it, people's clothes and stuff. And then all of a sudden she stops talking and she gives this expression. And then she changes her tone toward talking towards Ruby. She says, but hey, you've really proven yourself. And I thought, you know, what does that expression mean? There's stuff that when she does that stuff, I'm literally looking at it going like, oh, there's something behind that expression.
Oh, yeah. She's a dreadful bitch. she's either being mean or she's saying something that if there's any question of her being nice, it's sarcastic.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about Lightning Strike some, because we don't know much about her as a person. She's actually like a force of nature in this book. She comes around, she's just basically blasting stuff. And yet, you know, both times we've seen her, she interacts with Geek Girl. And I'm kind of wondering, is there some kind of connection between the two of them?
Well, no. I mean, it's not... Geek Girl gets into this mm-hmm. by... You know, she's flying around looking for stuff, and this is what she happens to come across now. So we've got two encounters with Lightning Storm in the first issue. The first one is the incident with Neon Girl. But then what happens later on is, you know, Geek Girl is looking for some, you know, to hear some sort of lightning strike or something to know where to find her. So she goes for Lightning Storm. But where Lightning Storm is at that time, Lightning Storm is then targeting Pitbull. So first issues, it seems like Lightning Storm is trying to take the big gun superheroes of the map. Okay. But this is an enigmatic figure. So the direction things go in, you'll think one thing, and then there's a curveball thrown in as we go through many series. So again, it's a layered character that is not as clear cut as she may appear to be at first, and very much a mysterious figure. I mean, Lightning Storm after the first issue kind of goes into the background before we build towards the climactic battle with her and Ruby, and we're concentrating on other characters in issues 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm. I got to ask about one more character, and it's the major superhero girl's brother. You know, you were talking about the fact that things may not be as it seems to be, and when he comes in and he talks with the doctors and things like that, I'm getting mixed signals from him as to what's going on and his attitude towards what's happening. Are we going to see more of him as things go forward?
We may do. The thing with him is he's Neon Girl's brother / agent. Mm-hmm. So he's on one side, he's obviously concerned about his sister, and the other side he's concerned about what she looks like now she's been fried by Lightning Storm. I mean, one of the first things he's saying is, well, don't worry. The health, he's almost implying that the health thing is secondary. We can fix up what she looks like physically. He knows the guy that did Burt Reynolds. Don't worry about that. That's all in hand. Mm-hmm. So, he's an agent. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, it's his sister he does care about. But there's two things going on with this guy.
No, one other thing I want to talk about was the use of color. I thought, like, the use of skin tones and colors in her costume and things like that. The colorist is listed as NAHP. Is that like an abbreviation for somebody's name or...
That's just the name. His actual name is Stefan Lemineur, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Well, maybe it's to prevent people ending that with "Am I pronouncing it correctly?" That he's gone under the sort of shortened NAHP or NARP. That's the name he uses as an artist, the colorist. But fantastic job. Mm-hmm. But we've got two colorists. Chunlin Zhao comes in issue 2, but you wouldn't necessarily notice much difference. They're both very, very high quality. I mean, the entire creative team, the letterers as well. Paul McLaren is the main one. Mike Gunnell does issue 2. It's It's a very good, strong creative team.
It's excellent.
I'm sure I've just got Micah's surname wrong. So yeah. Apologies, Micah.
Well, you know, someday in comics, people are going to put pronunciation guides for people's names so that we don't have to struggle with it. But until then, we have to kind of, you know, some people have to understand that if we mangle the name, it's because we tried really hard to get it right.
Well, as you know from before, when we've had my co-writer on the Almighty's, Mike Gagneau, mm-hmm. the amount of ways that gets mispronounced, because that's not how it's spelled. So, yes, I'm very familiar with that.
Okay, I want to touch on that, too, in just a minute. But before we get to that, issue number one now, coming out on November 2nd. When is issue two scheduled to come out? If you said you're pretty much done as far as issue two goes. Are you going to do it monthly? How's it going to come out?
Yeah, it's going to come out monthly. I'm putting it together for the printers this weekend, so I'll be looking at the date. It'll be more or less a month after. I haven't decided on the exact date yet. I mean, one thing I'm considering a little bit with issues two and three schedule is we're coming out in December and January, so getting the timing right so they don't get, you know, lost amid Christmas and New Year. But early December it will be.
Okay.
And also, just to clarify there, issue two is lettered by Micah Myers. That's his name.
Okay. And not the Michael Myers, but a Michael
not,
Myers.
Not Michael Myers. Let's not confuse it again. Micah. M-I-C-A-H.
All right. Good. So I want to make sure we get people's names right if we all can. Which is a great thing to do that. Now, you brought up Almighty's. You know, you've mentioned that Geek Girl you've got big plans for, the four-issue miniseries, and then you're going to go on to an ongoing. How's the Almighty's doing these days? You and Mike, are we going to see more of the Almighty's in the future?
Yeah. I mean, you can still the second print of the Almighty's, for people that aren't aware, it's a comedic super team. It's kind of pokes fun at the genre. It's comprised of two characters by Mike and two characters by me, and we've had an issue one and an issue zero. The issue one's got a second print. You can still get both of those. The website's almightysamass.com, and there's a free digital preview comic of it there as well, so you can have a look at it first. But yeah, that's as that stands, that's a series of one shots effectively. So the third one is well underway. I think we're up to page 19 on the artwork. So yeah, there's more to come of that. I mean, the thing with that is, whereas with Geek Girl, it was kind of me and Carlos working on this to a fixed schedule and Carlos not working on anything else. With the Almighty's, you know, everyone involved in it has got other things going on as well. Like Eleonora, who's the main art. We've used a few artists, but Eleonora has been involved in all of them and is illustrating almost all of the third one. We've got a separate prologue bit with different artists, but she's the sort of constant in the art side, and she, you know, she's got a lot on. She teaches, so yeah, it's something I enjoyed doing, and I want to once issue three has come out to do a collection of them. But yeah, it's this you know, this if you like a lighter take but with an edge. A Family Guy is the thing I compare its humor to most. So robot Nazis and Cockney werewolves and kebab men that work for Barack Obama for no explicable reason, all that kind of nonsense. So yeah, if you want to check out what we've already done on that, you'll be able to get them at the Almighty's Amass site.
There's a cover that really I enjoy. There's a meme that goes around where Batman is slapping Robin, and they're always writing that. There's one of the covers actually has one of your characters slapping another in the same exact most of that. I really like that. It always makes me laugh when I see that.
Yeah, that's the second. Yeah, the infamous meme of Batman bitch slapping Robin. So yeah, we recreated that with Mike's two characters, Mason, who's a borderline psycho, and Nightfang, who's the aforementioned cocky British punk slash werewolf. Yeah, they don't get along so well, so they were a good fit to do a parody of that one.
Now, as far as this issue coming out, you were talking about your 19 pages in. Do you have a schedule yet as far as that, when that might show up?
No, I mean, another thing is, I've written a Miss F. Miss F is one of the characters, mm-hmm. in the team. Former downtrodden superheroine, former downtrodden housewife turned swinging superheroine. So I've written a one off of that, and I want that to come out before it, because it takes place before the third one. It kind of bridges, you know, with there having been a gap between the last one and the next. This bridges the gap between the two. So I want that to come out first, and that's only done in terms of scripts. So we've not got any definitive schedule yet, but it's all, you know, I mean, I'd say the third Almighty is, you know, a good way in.
Okay. Now, Cabercini, how's that character doing? Because she's one of those fun characters. You'd take a really interesting twist as far as her powers go.
Yeah, Cabercini, ex hooker junkie, now voodoo junkie, who's made her own bastardized version by mixing it with other magics and using them on sort of supernatural hits. So that's the 4-issue miniseries of that is almost done. What I'm going to be doing is there's a Cabercini Voodoo Junkie Hitwoman Facebook group, and what I'm planning to do is have issue one available just there at the end of the year, and then the full 4-issue miniseries will come out monthly at other outlets sometime next year. And partly the reason I'm doing it that way is so that I can give Geek Girl as much attention as it needs, because that's going to be November, December, January, February. But Carver is another, similar to Ruby, well, and very dissimilar to Ruby, but similar in that there's a character arc, there's a story to tell in terms of, you know, where this person starts and where they're going. And it's something I'm very invested in. There's, I think, 5 pages left to do of the 4-issue miniseries. So we're not far off on that.
Any other projects you're working on we should know about?
No, I mean, right now, you know, my head is a Geek Girl, so I'm all about, you know, developing the ongoing to follow. So that's really, because it's nice to have that, you know, already, you know, that's already been signed up with Marcosia, that there will be a series following the mini. So it's nice to have that sort of breathing space where you haven't got to, you know, try and get everything, because, you know, Geek Girl will work as a 4-issue mini series, but it's nice to know that you can continue beyond that, and that these characters will have a life beyond that, and we can develop them and get to know them and develop the relationship between Summer and Ruby, which is at the heart of the series. And, you know, there's going to be ups and downs in that. And it's actually just only really just struck me, though it has occurred to me before, but with that being that the center of it, when you mention about Pitbull, mm-hmm. And Ruby as a potential romantic interest, yes, that could happen. But in this miniseries, the relationship of it is Summer and Ruby, so it's quite nice to have something that doesn't, you know, have like a romantic thing, and to look at a different type of relationship. It's quite unusual, and it's nice to you know, get to know these two as best friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is coming out right around Halloween. And, you know, you've got this a lady that goes around and dresses up like Geek Girl. I've seen pictures of her. Is she the main one, or are there other ones that are dressing up like Geek Girl these days? How's that going?
Well, that goes right back to issue zero. So that's going back a bit. I mean, that's a friend of mine, Amy. Mm-hmm. So She's pregnant at the moment, so that's not a fair way in, so that's probably not ideal for her at the moment. I mean, people have talked about cosplaying Geek Girl, and the first convention I'm doing with this is Thought Bubble in Leeds, England, which is the first weekend in November, the week the book comes out. But I'm also going to be doing the Yorkshire Cosplay Convention next year, so I'll be looking at trying to have, if not Amy, then a cosplayer in hand for that. But people have digged the look and have said, they want to cosplay as us, so that's a nice thing.
Very good. Well, Sam, you're doing wonderful stuff as always, and I hope Geek Girl number one is a big success and the miniseries goes real well, and looking forward to the ongoing as well. So, man, keep it up.
Thank you, Wayne.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Frank Martin, the creator of Modern Testament Anthology of the Ethereal from Insane Comics, who's got a very interesting offering out these days. How you doing, Frank?
Hey, how you doing, Wayne?
We were just talking about it before we started to record, the fact that I'm a little puzzled as to how to explain this thing that you're making present. And it's a perfect thing for a Halloween podcast. Talk about what it is that you're making available to people.
So what I like to call it is it's a dual novella. It's basically two stories packed into one product. They don't have anything to do with one another. They're each standalone stories. But they're the iconic monster creatures. One revolves around vampires, and one revolves around a werewolf. And in the print version, it's dual-sided. So you could read one story, you finish it, you could flip it over and read the other story. It's kind of like the old pulp magazines, kind of in that flavor. Cool. And as bonus, at the end of each story, I have a 5-page comic short. So you get two short novellas and two short comics, all in one package, which it's a little bit of a hodgepodge, but I think it's fully loaded for Halloween.
Well, this is good because, some of us like to read both. You know, I like to read comics as well as I enjoy a good novel or a novella kind of story. So it's great to do it. I have to ask right off the bat, because this is something that always puzzles me, is that people can either do one or the other, but I don't know many people who can do both. So I have to ask you, was there what challenges came to you from writing the novella parts versus the comic parts? Did you have one that you preferred, or was it it's just like trying to choose from your own children kind of thing? They just happen to be different.
It really depends on the project, really depends on the story. I think any creator, when you come up with an idea, the idea just comes, and you got to think, where can I get the most bang for my buck? What medium is going to pack the most punch for this particular story? So, if I came up with an idea and I'm going to say, I think this will work better as a prose story, I think this will work better as a film, in which case you got to write a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And as we see a lot of times with adaptations of comics that become movies or movies that actually have a comic adaptation, there's pros and cons to both. So mm-hmm. you kind of see which what you can give and take for each one, because it's definitely doesn't translate perfectly.
But do you have a preference between the two? I mean, they're talking about three now. You're talking about screenplays and stuff too. Is there one that you prefer?
Want to take a step further? We could go with regular plays, stage plays,
okay.
Radio serials. We could go all night.
Okay.
But do I have a personal preference when writing them?
Mm-hmm.
Not really.
Okay.
I think I enjoy reading stories and I enjoy reading comics, and they both, from a technical standpoint, they both come with their challenges, mm-hmm. and they both come with their benefits. For instance, when you're as a writer, when you're writing a prose story, you're speaking directly to the audience. You know, the readers, you have a direct connection to the reader. Whereas when you're a comic writer, you're basically, to put it crudely, you're using the artist as a tool mm-hmm. in order to speak to the reader. So it's a little bit of you're a step away from your audience.
It's really interesting to me. As I said before, I think some people want to do one or the other. They don't necessarily want to do both or all these different venues. But I think it's a great thing that you like doing all of them. It's the story that seems to communicate which way you want to go.
To be honest with you, when I first really started to take my writing into a public setting, and I was actually started putting it out there and jiving with other writers, I was surprised at how many don't do more, how many don't do both. I find a lot of comic writers just stick to comics, and I find a lot of prose writers who write horrors and novels and horror and sci-fi and fantasy novels don't really venture into comics. And connecting with them and networking them, I've actually seen some of them say, you know what, if Frank's doing this, why not I give it a shot? And I ran into a bunch of writers who have tried to dabble in writing some comics and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Not to pat myself on the back as an example, but... Mm.
Well, you know, honestly, I know so... I've run into so many people who do one thing, and they want to do that one thing really well. So it's kind of like when you've got a hammer, everything's a nail. Mm-hmm. Kind of a setup, and I always admire people who can do more than one kind of storytelling. So that's a big thing for me.
Yeah, I see that a lot when you don't want to try to fit a story into a medium that it doesn't belong in. Mm-hmm. And you ever go to a movie and you watch and you end the movie and you're like, yeah, it was okay, but it would have worked a lot better as a comic. Mm-hmm. Or even the other way around, you read a comic and you're like, yeah, this would have been better just watching this on the screen. Mm-hmm. So. Not that every comic writer has the resources to turn their idea into a movie, but sometimes you just run across a story that you feel would work a lot better in a different medium.
Well, before we dive into the different stories, would you like to see your stuff get turned into screenplays and maybe end up being on the big screen or a small screen?
Sure. I would say my ultimate goal is to be a screenwriter. When I first started, trying to be a professional writer, I wrote a bunch of different screenplays, so that's kind of how I started out. And so I do have some screenplays written, and I even have some screenplays that I think are great stories that that I might actually try to put into a medium that might have a more commercial viability for me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. I love writing screenplays, and that's actually my preferred format as far as telling a story.
Well, you know, Jeff Johns was a screenwriter before I became a comic person.
Mm-hmm.
He had written, he worked with, I can't remember the name of the gentleman who worked on Superman 2. He had worked with that person. And
Richard Donner.
Yeah, that's the person he had worked with. And so you kind of get that sense of a visual orientation towards writing. You know, not lots and lots and lots of text going on, lots and lots of standing talking going on.
A little bit. There's definitely some of the ways of writing a screenplay definitely translate into writing comics as far as scripts go. Mm-hmm. The big difference, obviously, is that comic scripts need to deal with static images, and everything's moving on the film, which is what we refer to as a moving picture. So mm-hmm. you really gotta break out of that idea of seeing things moving and getting still frames going, telling a story through still frames.
Now, I also want to ask, you've got, like, as if this was a novel, you've got covers for the two stories, and I just wondered, who did the artwork for those?
An artist by the name of Chris Winters. He did the cover art for both stories, which were phenomenal, I think personally, and he also did the interior comic art as well. Oh. They're silent comics. There's no dialogue to them, but he mm-hmm. did any artwork that you see. He was responsible for it, and I think he did a phenomenal job.
Oh wow, very cool. Excuse me one second. I'm really interested because on the cover for the vampire one, you've got a very unique looking vampire. And there, a huge mouth, sort of a venom-like tongue, and then you've got the up-and-down vampire fangs. And I'm just kind of fascinated by that. Was that his concept on what you had written, or was that something the two of you had come up with? As we read the story, we should have that kind of a vampire in our heads going along?
Yeah, I wanted to, right off the bat, I wanted to. The idea behind the story, without giving too much of the story itself away, was that there's a lot of lovey-dovey vampire stories out, and that's the big complaint of horror fans, is that we got this vampires have turned away from their monstrous roots to kind of become this mystique lovers. Mm-hmm. So giving the story a subtitle that says a story of love will actually play towards those undertones, but at the same time, I wanted to bring the story back to its roots of having really monstrous vampires involved. So the image on the cover is going to bring you towards that, to that the vampire is definitely a creature in this. He's not some lovey-dovey guy. And at the same time, the subtitle is going to kind of pull your string in that same direction that's popular nowadays.
Well, after having read it, you can definitely say this is not a Twilight story going on there. For those people who like Twilight, then this may not be your thing. But for those people like me who prefer horror to be horrible or horrific or whatever you want to use for it, I much prefer this kind of thing. I would much rather have things, you know, us sitting there and just, you know, wondering what's going to happen next, rather than sitting there going, oh, who's going to fall in love with who and who's going to, all that stuff.
Well, that was my ultimate goal. I don't know. You could tell me if I was successful or not in it, in that I wanted to start the story off in a way that made it seem like I was going to go in that direction, where we have a smooth-talking vampire who's very handsome and they all fall in love, and then just pivot, shift right on a gear and say, nope, that's not really what's going on.
Well, I thought it was really good. I liked it. I thought the way you did it was really inventive and moved things along real nicely. The story seems to focus around a girl by the name of Laura, and she, I hate to say this, but it's so true of some ladies, they like the bad boys.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up, well, we don't want to get too far into the story and give away, spoil stuff, but she's drawn to a circumstance that she probably shouldn't be, which I know a lot of women who have gone into that same kind of situation. She starts out pretty much together, it seems like. And as the story progresses, she changes, let's say. I don't want to indicate any kind of direction. And when we get to the end, it's quite she's a very different person than when we start out. And, you know, I felt for her all the way through the process, and her sister is involved by the name of Jessica, and all these things that happen, and you do a very a good job of explaining some of the situations she goes through, shall we say. And I was kind of like, woof, you know, is it getting hot in here or what kind of stuff. And I'm just kind of fascinated by that. On some levels, this seems to me like a cautionary tale to some of us who like, to some people who like, who are drawn to the darker side of things. We might want to be careful about that.
Yeah, it wasn't my intention, but it kind of turned to that by the end. My ultimate goal with the two sisters was to create kind of, I don't want to say polar opposites, mm-hmm. but the older sister might have made some mistakes that she sees her younger sister going down, mm-hmm. and wants to stop her from taking part of him before it's too late. And as Wayne read the story, sometimes that you don't get there in time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, and I have to say too, is that it was a great use. I fret at people constantly about the use of commas and things like that and text, but I really enjoyed the fact that you got your commas right in there, because, you know, I always like to point out to people, there's a big difference between let's eat, comma, grandpa, and let's eat grandpa. Two different very, you know, sentences as far as those goes. And I thought that, you know, your grammar was all together. I never stumbled over something because something wasn't quite right. And that's a big deal to me, because I read a lot of indie comics, and the commas are sort of sprinkled here and there wherever they kind of figure, oh, we need a comma about now. And so for me to actually read with grammar that's correct, and I also like the fact that when you got to the end of a chapter, you often used white space and then start another chapter at the beginning of a page, mm-hmm. which is a great way, because, you know, not many of us can sit and read, you know, a novel at one time or even a novella at one sitting. So what that does is that gives us a place to put in a little bookmark or come back to it. And I always like that. I appreciate that so much, because
you can definitely thank my this was published by indie publisher Burning Willow Press. Mm-hmm. And this book, as opposed to most, it really was a team effort as far as bringing it to market, mm-hmm. because the b- between the Kindle version, which is obviously not dual-sided, there's one story and there's another story. The print version, which is dual-sided, was a tremendous formatting effort. So between the publisher, the formatter, you got cover arts, the cover designer, and the editor, which is I credit towards all the correct grammar that you've been talking about. It really was a team effort into making this project a reality.
You know, because I read things on the internet and I read things all over the place, and I'm forever bumping into things that stop me. You know, I can't keep reading that kind of stuff, and I realize people are trying to get away from that kind of thing that's too structured in their minds, but I would 10 times rather be able to read a story that lets me flow with it than something that doesn't. So I really have to congratulate you, because it was so nice for a change to read something that actually flowed right. So I really like that a lot.
Thanks, I appreciate that. And one of the big conversations with indie writing, either comics or indie publishing just in general, is the do I want to go with the publisher route or do I want to go the self-publisher route? And self-publishing definitely has its pros in that you can really control it from start to finish. But I think that's also one of its cons, is that you're in it by yourself. When you go to a publisher and you go to a publisher that you trust and that you rely on, you're not alone. You have a kind of a team to lean on to help you and to work through with you, and they catch your mistakes, because one person can't really do it all, you know?
Oh, that's true. I agree with that. That's great. Now let's get to the comic that's at the end of the first story. It's very much of a monster story. Is it really a vampire story? I guess it is, in the sense that people transform and then there's a battle that takes place up in the sky. So it must my problem is I've read too many Man Bat stories in Batman, and I'm forever thinking, is that Man Bat? Who is that? But it actually is a vampire, isn't it? It's
a monstrous vampire. I would put it that way.
Okay.
So my ultimate goal with the comics at the end is there's two separate comics. Mm-hmm. They're both 5 pages. Mm-hmm. They're both called Horrors of War, which I've called them both the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they're not connected, but they're very similar, mm-hmm, in that they're vampire versus werewolf stories.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. You know, the nice thing is – see, the great thing to me, though, is the contrast. You've just gotten done doing a story completely told with words, and now you get into a place where you are not depending on words. Which, again, I think is just a wonderful way. I wish more writers could flex those different kinds of muscles, because I think of certain TV writers, in fact, who, you know, just volume after volume after volume, and, you know, the script's just full of dialogue. And I'm always kind of getting to I get to the end of the thing, and I'm kind of like, well, somebody hit somebody. I just literally just want somebody to hit and to do that kind of thing. But with your stuff, I was always moved along with it. And of course, so much happens in those 5 pages.
Yeah, I was always a big fan of Marvel in the early 2000s. I believe did a little marketing stint called Enough Said. Mm-hmm. Where they put out a whole line of comics that start to finish, full 22-page comics, didn't have a single line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you could call it gimmicky, but at the same time, it's an exercise, it's a challenge, and to see writers and artists try to pull that off is very cool. I always love to see trying new things. So for this, yeah, I got 2 short comics. These are battle comics. These are versus comics. They're fight comics, and that was my ultimate goal with them. We don't need to see these guys talk. Just go right at it.
That's a great thing.
So yeah, that was the ultimate goal, to try to pull these stories together, is that I got one werewolf story, one vampire story, and then we're going to throw in the middle 2 comics of werewolf versus vampires. So that was the ultimate mindset behind that.
So the great thing is that both ways engage our imaginations, but sometimes you have to use your writing, you have to be better at your words in order to pull us into the story, otherwise we'll get bored a little quickly. And so I never was bored with either of these stories as far as it goes. I just kept flipping the page to see now what, which is always good. That to me is a sign of something that's worth reading, is when I can sit there and just keep going and keep going and keep going. So I like that. Let's get to the second story. It's Ordinary Monsters High School and the Final Solution. And this has less to do with vampires. It has to do with Nazis.
Nazis and werewolves always. Yeah. For some reasons, I don't know why, Nazis and werewolves always go together like macaroni and cheese.
So where did the concept come for the second story?
So this story was a lot deeper rooted in that in college, I saw a documentary, and it was a documentary by Steven Spielberg where he went on a mission to film Holocaust survivors to record their stories before they all died out because they're getting old, you know? And this was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So reading all their stories and hearing all their stories, I kind of got inspired a little bit in that I wanted to bring it to a science fiction level, and that werewolves and vampires always go together. And I also, between that and another book I read by Christopher Browning, which I kind of stole the title from, which is called Ordinary Men. He quoted a Battalion and the Final Solution, which is basically about how the people who carried out the Holocaust were what he used in the title, ordinary men. And they weren't necessarily vehement Nazis. They were kind of just regular guys that were put into a very evil situation. And the question throughout the book was, how could regular people carry out such evil acts? Mm-hmm. And the metaphor, whether you got it or not, was to use werewolf, the concept of a werewolf, the fact that we have evil within us that can come out at any time, to express that. Mm-hmm. So combining those two sources of inspiration, I kind of have a story that jumps back and forth between the time of World War II mm-hmm. and the current day, to have an ordinary high schooler who has this kind of apathy, this hate that's boiling inside of him, mm-hmm. come out as he becomes a werewolf.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing I liked about the differences between this story and, say, on the first one, was told from third person. This one is told from first person. We are looking at he's describing what's happening to him from his point of view.
Yeah, another way I tried to mix it up to create a total package with one book is to give the reader a different feel.
Mm-hmm. So as far as like the characters and stuff go, because they felt really real to me, were they based on people you know, Greg, Eric, all these people? Were they imagination burst, or are they people that you knew that you kind of employed in this circumstance?
Interesting question. I would say in some of my stories, yes, real characters are inspired by real people. Mm-hmm. In this one, not so much. Hmm. They're actually kind of just imaginary characters that I made up. But that said, you can't help but put your own experiences in relationship with people that bleed through subconsciously. So there might be some real people thrown in there, but for the most part, I didn't have anybody in particular in mind when coming up with these fellows.
Because I always like to tell the story that I got to talk to David Peterson, and I asked him about Mouse Guard. I said, are these characters based on like the Knights of the Round Table? Who are these people? And he said, oh, these are me and my friends. I know these people. I can tell what they're going to do, and so it's not very difficult for me to figure out what they're going to do in these different circumstances. And I was really kind of flummoxed by that. I kind of figured that these were like some sort of classic characters that he was doing. But
it's actually not a bad way to write a story. Just have them based on real people, and then think, what would Joe do in this situation?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of funny that happened. Ever since then, I've always looked at stories a little differently since he answered that question that way. So that's why I had to ask you. I wanted to know, were these friends of yours? Were these just...
No, in this instance, no. I've never had a friend that turned into a werewolf, so...
Okay. Now, another thing you do in that latter story that I really like is, and some people probably just go nuts on it, but I happen to really like it, is the use of different typefaces.
Yes, that was a big push when I was working with the publisher. I was like, I need to have them in different fonts or a different way to differentiate between his werewolf voice and his normal voice.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. I mean, you get a sense of what's happening. And again, use the same circumstances where if you end a chapter, then you put like a white space so that we can get it at the top of the page for the next time, which I like. I think all that kind of stuff is that's readability is something that people don't take into consideration very often. And it's something that's so important because I had this friend of mine. He wrote a story. We were trying to write like a Trek fan film, is what we were doing. And we were our own little ship. And he talked about a week. The name of the thing was A Week on This Ship. And it took about a week to read the story. That was the hard part of it. Mm-hmm. And see, things like you're doing, you're employing, are things that would have made that story a lot easier to get through.
Yeah, I was talking to some people and they said, you can't do that. That goes against everything that writers are supposed to do. Writers are supposed to use their skill to differentiate between voices, and it's supposed to come through in the writing. I was like, but I don't want to do that. I want it to be blatantly obvious that there's two different voices inside this person that are battling to come out, and I want to make it as blatantly obvious as possible.
But you have all these tools at your disposal. Why not use them?
Yeah.
So I don't understand that. I can never figure why you have to do that. Because even a good justification for this looks like in the recent Batman comics where Scott Snyder was writing the Joker. Whenever the Joker spoke, his text looked different from everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that made him something different from all the rest of us in there. And I had the same thing when I read your story. When things were going on, you can really kind of tell when things are shifting because the font's changing. And then that way you're using the text to do almost a visual representation of what's going on.
I think that's why I'm a big fan of comics in general, is that there's so many different ways to play around with the medium, in that you can do so many different things to tell your story in an out of the box kind of way. And I know we had talking about Modern Testament in the last podcast, our last conversation, and in the volume 3 coming up, I do have a story which I'm pretty proud of, where I do kind of push the envelope in a little bit as far as what's traditionally done in comics and what's not, which I hope you enjoy when it comes out.
Oh, can't wait. I'm dying to see that. I've enjoyed Modern Testament very much. I've seen both the first and the second. Before we get to that, let's talk about how do people get this collection?
This book?
Yeah.
It's available on Amazon now. Okay. You can the name of the stories are In Skin Deep and Ordinary Monsters. You can search those two stories. And it should pop up on Amazon, and as we mentioned, it's available both in Kindle and print. And the print version is something I'm particularly proud of because it is a double-sided book. You could read one, and then you're done, and you could flip it over and read the other. So it's definitely unique.
Great. So I'm glad to hear that because I think variety, as I always like to say, is something I look forward to. And to see this kind of variety in the storytelling is very encouraging to somebody who's used to same old a lot of the time. So really like that. So that's now available. Why don't we talk about Modern Testament and where you are with that? You've already talked about the fact that the volume 3 is in the works. How far is that going along? How soon do you expect volume 3 to be available?
Volume 3 currently has a release date of December.
Okay. So you're knee deep in it right now.
Oh, it's – yep. And volume 4 does not have a release date, but it is in production. And I believe that will be the last volume of the last traditional or official volume of the series.
Okay, but you could always do little stories here and there if you wanted to.
That's the great thing about shorts, is that you can always just bust one out if you get the urge to.
Well, Frank, you're doing great stuff. I highly encourage people, if you haven't been reading this stuff, please go ahead and do it. And I think, if I remember, it's Insane Comics that has Modern Testament.
Insane Comics is publishes Modern Testament. Burning Willow Press is the indie horror publisher that does Skin Deep and Ordinary Monsters.
So if we want to keep up with you, Frank, how do we do that? Is that like Facebook? What's the way to keep up with you?
You can check out my author page on Facebook, which is facebook.com/FrankMartinWriter. Mm-hmm. And I'm on Twitter, and my handle is @FrankTheWriter.
Great, Frank. Well, I've enjoyed your stuff. And again, I highly recommend, if you haven't read this stuff, dive in, because I think you're going to get a different experience than what you've had before, which I always love. And I'm looking forward to more stuff. When that third volume comes up, boy, I got to get me a copy of that. So I'm looking forward to that. I really enjoyed it. So keep up the great work, Frank. Just terrific.
Thanks, Wayne.
It's great to welcome to the podcast Jack Montgomery, the illustrator of a really fascinating book called Sanguine Knights.
Yep.
Talk to me a little bit about the fact that I always get a kick out of the fact that in comics, knights or knight are always prefaced by a different word, like it's Black Knight or Atomic Knights or stuff like that. Your book, and of course, you're the illustrator, I'm not exactly sure how much input you had on the story and everything. But why don't you talk a little bit about how Sanguine Knights came to be?
Sure. I was brought in later in the project here as the artist. Right after I graduated college, I was approached by a friend of a friend, Dave Jensen, who's the author and creator. I'm looking for an artist here. He wrote the book a couple years ago with a friend, and they had this post-apocalyptic vampire story that they pitched to me, and I went home with him. He gave me a beer, and we talked about the project. I threw him some pictures, and he decided to bring me on. And it was an exciting story, and the beer helped too. But it's basically Sanguine is a post-apocalyptic vampire western. Is how it was pitched to me, and all things I'm pretty interested in. And I love Mignola and a lot of other illustrators that monsters and horror, and so it was right down my alley.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to say, there's a really interesting foreword that's written by Brad Chisholm. And he says a couple sentences, I just got a quote, they're really funny. It says, in Sanguine Knights, you'll meet a political Dracula. You'll empathize with a differentially abled protagonist with a fondness for discarded kitchen appliances. You'll willingly submit to a doomed quest. You'll question your own moral certainties. And you'll do these things because Sanguine Knights takes full advantage of the form we call the graphic novel. So I just love that whole description, because a lot of that stuff is just different from what I'm used to reading in vampire literature and things like that. Because, you know, for a while there, vampires were hot and heavy, and then all of a sudden werewolves came on. And I kind of think that vampires are making a resurgence. So to talk about the business, because I was listening to you on the Canned Air podcast to our friends of mine out of Ohio, and they were having great fun with it about the fact that there's this, we don't want to start necessarily at the end, but there's this great last panel with Dracula that the guys on that podcast really loved. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I think Dave Jensen, along with a lot of other horror fans, were pretty offended by what Twilight did to the vampire genre here. Mm-hmm. But our pitch pretty much at every convention since we got the book published here has been, do you like vampires? And then followed up by, do you want them to stop sparkling? So it's basically Dave wrote Sanguine Knights hoping to bring vampires back to like that visceral monster type depiction. So it's been fun to kind of draw. I'm a big monster fan, so it's been fun to draw the more visceral side of vampires and kind of bring that back out into the vampire story. Because Dave also mixes a lot of different stuff, new stuff into vampires. He likes a lot of Sumerian lore with some of the gods and demons from that genre and mythology. So he's incorporated some new stuff, stuff that he was hoping would kind of connect different cultures and stories. And it's been kind of cool to mix that ancient lore with some modern, like, apocalyptic storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like it. And, of course, your characters are one of the things I think that really make this book shine. Because there's the one character, of course, I liked, and whenever I hear people talk about this book, they're always talking about Mr. Temple, Jackson Temple, who is the guy who has like a mechanical arm that he can put on and take on bad things. But he's a great big guy. He's very nice to people, you know. I'm used to people being that size to be the bad guy. But early in the thing, there's a lady who comes up and finds that she's found a toaster. And he's trying to find some way to help her and give her money for that. And so he's kind of shopping it around to other people that he knows. And I kind of like the fact that this guy is not really a badass on that sense, but he does have his fighting skills, as we find out later in the book. Do you know much about the character as far as how he was conceived? And also, did you base his visuals on somebody that you knew or knew of?
It's kind of funny because I'm pretty sure Jackson Temple's Dave Jensen.
Okay.
Because Dave is, you know, he doesn't put up with people's crap, and he's kind of an extroverted kind of tough guy. But he's a sweetheart, and he's always super helpful and a gentle big man. So he's basically, I think he's Dave. Dave had a pretty good idea of what he wanted Jackson Temple to look like when we started on. He wanted me to draw a mechanical arm, which terrified me because I had to figure out the mechanics of this guy's arm and draw it about 1,000 times. But it was fun, and after a while I figured out how it worked and how it moved, and it was kind of cool to figure out how like a functioning like limb made out of metal and moving parts kind of worked. So I learned a lot actually from drawing this comic book. But Dave and I, a couple of the characters in the book, like St. Isaac, Dave and I kind of worked through as we built the comic, but a couple of them, like Jackson Temple, we had a pretty good idea going into it of what he would look like.
Mm-hmm. What about the other characters? Did you have a little more input on what they were going to look like?
Yeah, Dave was actually super fun to work with because he was really collaborative. So when we came on, he had him and his buddy, Andy had, who's the co-writer of the book, kind of the original story. Dave put down a lot of the actual text and everything, but they came up with, some stills. Probably the first 14 pages were laid out in super rough, stick figure drawing, which was fun to kind of make look, more polished, but after that, we kind of laid out the rest of the comic together, and we're working on book two right now, and we're kind of working through it together, and Dave, I think we've kind of become partners in the fact that although he has most of the story laid out, as far as visuals go, we kind of trust each other to kind of come up with the look of the environment, and both are on the same page as far as the setting and tone we're setting for the rest of the story here.
Well, I like the way that you make vampires look. Mm-hmm. You know, big foreheads, kind of pointy ears, big lower teeth. Because most of the time, vampires have big upper teeth coming down to do the biting. But in this one, you've actually gone a different direction and stuff like that. Was it fun to do something different with vampires?
Yeah, that was one of the first things Dave told me when he started the book was that he wanted the lower vampires. Basically, it goes down the chain from the original vampires, and then as you go down the line of people who've been turned, they've kind of become more monstrous and just rely on brute force and, you know, just bloodlust. But it's so one of the first things we kind of cranked out was the look of the bestial lower vampires, which are throughout the first book kind of like the attack dogs that he brings along with him, the main character here. Mm-hmm. But it was fun to work on that. And again, I love drawing monsters, so to figure that out and kind of figure out how their skull looks, we kind of figured out the anatomy of their weird hunched over look and their huge underbite. It was fun to kind of change the look of the classic vampire into something more monstrous.
Mm-hmm. Which is really great. And, of course, we already mentioned Dracula, and you did a really great job, I thought, on portraying him. Although we only really see him at something of a distance, even he's got a very different look as far as vampires go.
Yeah. Dave, when we started the book, the main character, who's Legall, he's kind of this wandering vampire, mm-hmm. Much more human as far as his appearance goes, but he's one of the original vampires there. And then they had Dracula along those same lines. He was turned a long time ago, and so he has this more human appearance, but he's also at this point kind of the leader of all the vampires. So he's got this regal kind of King-like look at the end of this. We only show him a little bit in the first book here. Book two, what we're working on now, has a lot of backstory in Dracula, and you learn a little bit more about the character. But page two was pretty important. The last page of book one was pretty important because it kind of shows our main antagonist and his position as far as the vampires go in this world we made here.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to harbor on Dracula, but we've seen a lot of him in the last 10 years or so. Movies and a TV show based on him and all kinds of good things. And yet, even with all these decades and decades of Dracula, there's still places that you can go with Dracula with it. I just find that so fascinating that a character has that much depth to him that, you know, even a comic can go places that we've never considered before.
Right. Yeah. As far as there's a lot of monster lovers out there. A lot of my friends love the classic Wolfman and Frankenstein, vampire, Dracula and everything. And people have delved in pretty deep to Dracula, and it's fun to see what people, it's fun and not fun to see what people do. But, people have made some changes to that type of monster. As far as people combining different genres to see what you can do with a classic monster, it's pretty fun to see.
Now, I'm going to ask you, of course, you're listed as the illustrator, so did you do all the coloring and the lettering and the drawing and stuff for this book?
I did. For book one, I did all of the pencils, inks, coloring. Dave did a lot of the layout, and a lot of the dialogue was already laid out here. But I did basically all the visuals you see here on page to page. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it, but it must have been fun for somebody who loves to do this kind of monster tale.
It was, yeah. My handwriting now is just like, I don't know, like comic book, Comic Sans, basically. Oh. It's just how I write on everything now. But my penmanship's got a lot better. Towards the end of the book, it probably becomes a little more clean and you know. But I've done a lot more comics, worked on stuff since, and it's fun to see, you know, after cranking out a project like this and doing all the work, what kind of how you get your method kind of put in place and laid down.
Well, you do some interesting things with text in this book, too, to me. You know, some folks say you can never do a whole page with just text on it. But yet you do it in such a way that's interesting to read. You know, perhaps that's the way the script intended it. But it's fascinating to me when I got to there's a page or two where there's a dialogue going on. And you do the one person's dialogue has a black background with white text. The other person has, like, yellow with dark text on it. And, you know, the way that it's written and the way that you move it down the page is visually interesting, so that it keeps us going through the story like that. And I thought that was something that was a very interesting way, especially somebody who's an illustrator. Most illustrators want to draw all these things and make all these things visually happen. But to allow the text to tell the story at that part, I thought was a real challenge and really something I thought you did very well.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, I that's something that as I went through the book, I'm a big fan of comic books and I love reading. And I've read comic books where I was literally confused as to who was talking or what was happening in this dialogue and then what was from panel to panel. So as I was going through the book, I was kind of thinking as a reader and thinking how I could, you know, make each character's dialogue kind of stand out, especially on those pages where we wanted some heavy story. Where I think that the hand lettering maybe helped a little bit as far as add character to some of those pages where it's just text. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, typed lettering. It's kind of somebody put their hand down and is writing out this story. Mm-hmm. It kind of puts, you know, shows that there's a little more work put into this story than just a gradient like nightfall or like, you know, dusk kind of on this page with a bunch of letters on it.
Well, I also get a kick because it gives us that unsettled feeling necessarily, because, you know, most type is all very structured and you're in an unstructured world largely, and even the text reflects that. I thought that was a really well done idea.
Yeah, it was fun to kind of some of those pages where at first I was like, man, that text looks wonky. You know, you go back and you read some of them, like some of the old Image comics from the 90s where they got really weird, like even some of like Spawn, Todd's work there, where it's like they have really bizarre, strange text on those pages, and it almost looks messy, but it's, you know, it can add to the story. And I mean, I think for the gritty kind of look we were going for this book, it didn't really bother me, and I've heard from a lot of people that it kind of adds to the, you know, the more visceral kind of handmade feel of the whole story here.
It's really cool. It's a very moving story. I do want to comment also on the color. I thought the use of color is really good. You know, the highlighting of certain individuals and the use of blues and reds. When something bad's going on, we get a lot of red taking place, which I got a kick out of. And there's a lot of use of shadow and black backgrounds and things like that. So I really liked the way this was done. It was, you know, if you're going to deal with vampires, this is the kind of thing you're going to find yourself in. But, you know, it's really easy to fall into a trap of using the same kind of thing panel after panel. But you use all kinds of different shadings and stuff to make the things move as we read it. And I just thought that use of color was really special.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I grew up reading a lot of Hellboy, and Mike Mignola's work was one of my favorite growing up. And, I mean, that guy uses black like nobody else has ever seen. And there'll be like a bunch of pages of black and then this bright red, because the main character Hellboy is just like this red color that never leaves the page. But it's fun to kind of see what color can do when you have a pretty black palette, and see how to make things pop, not make stuff, I don't know, not too much in your face, but just kind of keep it subtle and keep that darker tone that you're going for throughout the book.
Which is great stuff. Was it easier for you to do this, like knowing you're going to do the whole thing as opposed to working with somebody else? Because you kind of have a feeling as to what you want it to eventually look like, instead of like passing it off to somebody. Was the process of making the whole thing happen, was that more satisfying to you or easier? How did that go with you? How did you feel about that?
I'm a pretty big perfectionist, and I like, you know, when I do my own stuff, I like to do it all. So if I draw a page, I usually like to color it and make it look the way I look. But Dave and I are pretty similar in how we wanted this book to look. It was Dave's vision, but you know, once he laid it out for me, I mean, it was right down my alley, and it was fun to kind of do a couple pages for him and see him react and be like, "That's what I was looking for," and I'm like, cool, because that's what I do. The rest of the book was pretty simple from that. The continuing to work with Dave has been fun, because we both have kind of a similar vision as far as how we want this to look in the end.
Sometimes when you work with somebody and you're on the same page, it just seems like magic somehow. The things
right.
happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so now the first book came out. How does somebody actually get a hold of the book? Is this something it's better to get a digital, or do you sell paper copies? How do you do this right now?
Yeah, we have a few copies here. Right now, mainly we're selling them at conventions around the Twin Cities here. We're trying to branch out and go to a couple other cons outside of the state. But we had an online store. We're trying to get it back up here. So before too long, it'll be available through our Facebook page. And I'm pretty sure it's just Facebook/ like Sangui Nights. But you can, if you look up Sangui Nights on Facebook, you can find our page, and we have links to our website and everything. But you can find the book through us. If you go there or send us a message, soon we'll have an easier way of accessing it. But right now we're mainly at conventions.
Is it at Comixology at all yet?
We're working on that too. We've been told by several friends that's somewhere it has to be. So we're getting that up there before too long, and then it'll be available on Comixology as well.
Because Comixology is a great way for people, if they can't get the paper copy, to at least read the story, at least dive into it.
Right.
And I understand you did a Kickstarter for the first one, and that there's a second Kickstarter coming?
Yeah, we have a second Kickstarter coming in a month or two here for book two. It's a trilogy, so we have book two, which is a lot of backstory, and then three is kind of our finale here. Our next Kickstarter is coming up soon. We'll let that notification of that launch on our Facebook page there. That's Kickstarter is also going to be with a couple other projects here. A buddy of ours, Doug Kalberg, is doing another comic book with us. He's a friend of us in the cities here. Mm-hmm. And then Space Skull, which is my own comic book that I've kind of written and drawn as well, is going to be a part of that. And that's something I've been working on in between Sangui Nights 2 and other projects here.
Well, you're a busy guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, actually. So talk a little bit about Space Skull. What's the basic premise about that one, if you can give us like the TV guide version?
Sure. So Space Skull is basically this, I'm a huge fan of heavy metal comic books and, you know, weird hyper-sexualized space barbarians from mid-70s kind of illustrations. So it's basically a sci-fi about Earth is dead and humans go to another planet to terraform, basically live there. And turns out there's another species that's living on this planet. So the first couple books, it's going to be a longer book, I think. I haven't really figured out the whole plan, but book one's almost done. And basically Earth fights with this alien species on this planet. They wipe each other out. And then through millions of years, all the death and decay that the result of this fighting transform the biology of the planet, and it kind of reverses where the plants become kind of meat and bone and the intelligent species becomes like this plant-based life. So it gets weird after a while, but the book one is kind of the leading up to the biological like transformation of this planet.
Okay, so you're laying the groundwork.
Exactly. Yeah. So the first couple books will probably be pretty brutal, and then after that it'll be this super strange sci-fi of meat plants.
I heard you once in this other podcast I was listening to describes like you like the strange and the weird.
I do.
And that's the kind of thing that we can look forward to in your good stuff. Anything else besides Space Skulls that's coming our way from you?
I got a couple other smaller projects, but nothing so big. Those are my two big ones right now. For the next couple months, I'll probably start letting people know either on our Sanguine Nights about other projects. But Sanguine and Space Skull are the big ones coming, and I'm just focusing on getting those guys out there.
Really cool, really cool. So we'll keep our ear to the ground for the Kickstarter to hit before long. Do you think that's going to hit before the end of the year, or do you think by the beginning of next year?
It may hit before the end of the year, but I would shoot probably for more early next year.
Okay. So now's the perfect time for people to get the first book.
Exactly.
And get ready to dive into the second one, so that's the ways to do it. Do you know any conventions that are coming up that you guys are going to be attending?
As far as this point goes, I know that both Dave and I wanted to kind of get the book further along and get this Kickstarter going before we head out to two more. So while the winter is kind of a dry spell here, we're spring cons are our big guy early next year, 2017. Spring cons over in the state fairgrounds here in Minneapolis. So that's the next big one we're going to. And then I think once we get with that out, we're going to try to make it out to Chicago and a couple other states bordering us here in the Midwest. But SpringCon, that's what we're shooting for.
Okay, very cool. Because there's like C2E2, and there's also Chicago Comic Con, all those kinds of good things. And I kind of think this book would really do a land office business in those kind of places. Because, you know, horror stories go over big in larger cities, it seems to me. So I think you guys should think about that, because that's a good place to put this book.
Absolutely, yeah. We have Dave and some of his buddies have always gone out to C2E2, and that's definitely something we're looking forward to. So that's something we're going to shoot for in the next year or two.
Very good, Jack. Well, man, it's great stuff, and it's good talking with you. And I'll have to talk with you again when other things start to percolate, too, because it's a lot of good things. When I got to read Sanguine Nights, and I do highly recommend it, it's really something different. If you want to read a vampire story that's still human and yet different from whatever you've read before, it's really great. I love, like you talked about, the structure within the vampire society. I like that. Reminds me of Deep Space Nine, where they had within the enemy forces all had these layers to them. And so I always enjoyed that, and I like that about this book, too. I think that's a great thing, because you're never exactly sure what you're going to bump into and how they're going to react within that.
Absolutely.
So it's very cool. So I really like that a lot, Jack. So keep up the great work, man, and I hope to get to talk with you soon. And I can't wait to see issue number 2 when Sanguine Nights number comes out. And we'll have to promote the Kickstarter when it comes around, because I'd like to see more of these good things. I love something different.
Great. Well, we'll let you know, Wayne. Thanks a lot.
And that that's a wrap for this very special episode. However, even though Halloween is on October 31st, we have more interviews coming that deal with the supernatural. That's going to include an update by Richard Rivera on Stabbity Bunny. There's a Kickstarter going on for that, and if you'd like to participate, be sure to go to Kickstarter.com and look up Stabbity Bunny number 5. Also, I'll talk with the two creators of Tainted Love, a really gripping vampire story that I really like. So be sure to listen to future episodes to get these interviews as well. But until next time, keep reading your comics.
What's that?
Another tumbler? Oh, you wouldn't be interested in that.
This baby works just fine.
So what do you think?
Does it come in black?